This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 6th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The U.S. military turns over an alleged rapist to Japanese authorities. France returns a U.S. citizen wanted in this country for the murder of an abortion doctor. And Florida's coveted governor's race is up for grabs. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Bush has revealed a new plan aimed at overturning a woman's right to choose by making unborn fetuses eligible for federal health insurance. Tara Alexander has more from the Capitol.
The Bush administration has drafted a policy designed to provide coverage for unborn children under the Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as CHIP. The federal program was designed to provide health care for low-income families. Lori Rubner, vice president of the National Partnership for Women and Families, says the proposal lacks support for living children. There are currently 10 million uninsured children in the United States.
This proposal does nothing to increase coverage for pregnant women. It doesn't add any new money to the CHIP program. These women can already get coverage under either Medicaid or CHIP. This is about granting legal personhood to a fetus. So the whole proposal is a sham. It has nothing to do with expanding coverage.
Pro-choice advocacy groups object to the policy, stating it could make unborn fetuses legal persons by granting eligibility for specific federal services. From the Capitol, I'm Tara Alexander for Free Speech Radio News.
Humanitarian aid to Cuba is being held at the Canadian-U.S. border in Maine, a joint project executed by Maine-based Let Cuba Live and Canadian Quebec-Cuba Friendship, attempted to drive four trucks loaded with medical equipment from the United States into Canada to bypass the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Steve Burke from the U.S.-based Let Cuba Live describes what happened at the border.
When we learned of their intention, we went out to our trucks, threw the ropes off, and started tossing out boxes to members of Let Cuba Live and their supporters, and proceeded to carry the aid across the border, and it was a scuffle. A lot of people got knocked down, and it went on for several hours, and we did manage to get probably a third of our shipment across the border. We passed it into the hands of our Canadian counterparts. It was a pretty powerful moment, an act of international solidarity.
In an effort to restrict blood donations from people who may have been exposed to mad cow disease, the Federal Food and Drug Administration has proposed a plan to ship blood from soldiers overseas to the New York region. Jeff Brady has this report.
The blood donation restrictions in New York come from rising concerns over tainted blood from people who may have been exposed to mad cow disease. Experts say New York City would be affected the most since it's the only place in the country to import blood from Europe. Dr. Robert Jones, president and CEO of the New York Blood Center, says it's only a theoretical risk that the human form of mad cow disease may be transmitted through a transfusion. But he says if servicemen become the primary donors for the New York blood supply, those who have lived in Europe would be turned away under specific criteria.
The policy as recommended by this committee, the deferral policy, requires a 5-year residence in a European country in order to be disqualified for donation.
Dr. Jones says military servicemen would also be subject to the same blood screening test for sexually transmitted diseases and viruses. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
U.S. grocery chains Food Lion and Cash & Carry nationally recalled their store brand white corn tortilla chips this week because they contain the genetically modified or GM corn called Starlink. The FDA issued a warning last month on Starlink when it was found in yellow corn products by people who experienced severe allergic reactions after eating food made with the product. Many food manufacturers switched to white corn, trying to avoid further contamination. And in the UK, people protesting GM products get arrested often, but despite the best efforts of prosecutors, don't get put in jail. Vivian Schweitzer reports from London.
The Crown Prosecution Service said that it plans to continue with criminal proceedings against protesters who damage genetically modified crops, despite losing its third major case in a year. The announcement was made as anti-GM supporters celebrated after a district judge acquitted on a legal technicality 11 people charged with criminal damage of a GM maize crop in Essex last year. The Crown Prosecution is concerned that environmental campaigners who challenged the law by nonviolent action are being acquitted by juries and magistrates, And even when people have been convicted of destroying GM crops, the legal system has shown sympathy. Martin Day, a partner with Lee Day Solicitors, which specializes in environmental cases, said that we are looking at a society which is far more in tune with the environment than it has been in the past. There's a feeling that the government and authorities have not been paying sufficient heed, and that the courts are now righting the balance. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Vivian Schweitzer in London.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
It's not a precedent, but it is rare. The U.S. has handed over a U.S. military man to face charges he raped a Japanese woman in Okinawa. Air Force Sergeant Timothy Woodland was taken into Japanese police custody today after U.S. Ambassador to Japan Howard Baker was assured the sergeant would receive the same legal rights he would in the U.S. At least one Marine has reported that the woman appeared to be protesting during the alleged incident. Woodland has denied he raped the woman and has contended that any sexual contact was consensual. CNN is reporting that Japanese authorities performed a polygraph test on Woodland, and they say he did not pass. Under a status of forces agreement with Japan, U.S. military members do not have to be handed over to Japanese authorities unless they have been indicted. This case will mark the first time a member of the U.S. military has been turned over before an indictment has been issued. The incident has magnified long-standing tensions between the U.S. military on Okinawa and the behavior of U.S. servicemen. Chalmers Johnson is president of the Japan Policy Research Institute and author of the book Blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire. He spoke with Free Speech Radio News about the history of U.S. military men's behavior on the island.
There have been repeated instances of sexual violence committed by American troops there. There are 38 bases on this small island and the three largest airfields in East Asia, and the Americans want to build a fourth one. And that, moreover, there's simply repeated incidents of arrogance on the part of the American commanders. So that this is not just problems of enlisted men, young enlisted men, who are sexually overactive. It reflects, above all, the lack of discipline imposed by their commanders. This is a long-standing problem. The rate of sexually violent crimes leading to court-martial continues to fluctuate around just under 2 per month in Okinawa.
Woodland's alleged rape has brought under scrutiny a growing schism between the U.S. State Department and the military. Johnson says the tensions between the two entities are as much about personalities as about politics.
The current highest-ranking officer in Okinawa is Lieutenant General Earl Hailston, a Marine officer. I simply don't understand the American government after a while. In my view, this officer is so incompetent, he should have been sacked a year ago. He has now managed to embarrass the United States quite badly by his incompetence 3 different times. Last summer, exactly a year ago, 2 weeks before the summit meeting in Okinawa, one of his subordinates, a Marine, in the middle of the night, broke into a home, crawled into bed with a 14-year-old girl, and mauled her until the police arrived, and he was forced to apologize for this. Hailston has been seen photographed any number of times in the governor's office with his usual tragic incident apology. Then in January, we had another case of a Marine molesting, in this case a 16-year-old girl in northern Okinawa in Nago. And at this time, Hailston again apologized, but then he was also put out an email to his subordinate commanders calling the governor and the members of the prefectural assembly nuts and a bunch of wimps, quote-unquote. And now we have this third incident, and Hailston was again seen apologizing to the governor. As I say, the man, as a Marine officer, and I'm not anti-Marine, he simply is unable to maintain discipline among his own troops. If he can't do it, they should have been withdrawn ages ago.
Crimes committed by U.S. soldiers against local Japanese in recent years have also led to protests and demands by local politicians for the withdrawal or reduction of U.S. troops. Johnson compares the Okinawa-U.S. relationship to that of the U.S. and the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, where the U.S. Navy is stationed amid growing calls for its departure.
The Japanese want to maintain the security treaty with the United States. The Americans claim they need forward deployment. The Japanese know full well that if these forward-deployed troops were in a politically influential area, the Japanese would have sent him home 30 years ago. They just simply wouldn't have tolerated it. So they put him down in Okinawa, which is a subordinated place. It was an independent kingdom until it was forcibly annexed by the Japanese Empire at the end of the 19th century, very similar to the United States' then expanding empire annexing Hawaii. And the Japanese have always treated people they've colonized as culturally inferior, and they do to this day. As I say, it would be a little bit like the Americans bombing Vieques. They wouldn't be able to bomb Long Island quite so easily.
Okinawa is home to about 26,000 U.S. troops, more than half the total stationed in Japan, which holds slightly more than a quarter of the total U.S. military presence in the Asia-Pacific region. Chalmers Johnson spoke with us from his home in San Diego. More whistleblowers have come forward at Duke Energy, one of a number of companies accused of manipulating California's energy market. In the first 3 months of this year, Duke's profits doubled. The North Carolina-based company's revenues rose from $7.29 billion between October and December of 2000 to $16.49 billion in the first 3 months of this year. Now, two former employees of Duke Energy have come forward. The workers, technicians at a Southern California plant, plan to testify before a legislative panel in Sacramento today. The employees are expected to tell the panel Duke deliberately kept generating capacity offline to jack up prices during rolling blackouts. Aaron Glantz reports from San Francisco.
Richard Connors was an operator at Duke Energy's Chula Vista plant near San Diego in January. He says California was in the midst of rolling blackouts when he asked his supervisor a question.
I did ask my foreman why it was that we had rolling blackouts right in the city within 20 miles of the plant. Areas of San Diego were being blacked out, and we had a 225 megawatt generator just sitting there. And he just shrugged his shoulders. Says, I really can't tell you. I'm not privy to that information.
Connors was one of two whistleblowers appearing at a press conference at California State Capitol Building in Sacramento. Both were former Duke employees, and both accused Duke of manipulating the state's energy market. Former Duke mechanic Ed Edwards said he was ordered to destroy over 23 pallets of parts that were needed for repairs at the plant. Edwards added that the plant was taken offline for unnecessary maintenance.
Duke ran this gas turbine with units offline or units at a minimum load. There is something to substantiate why they have done it, and I would like for them to explain, because there was no apparent reason for them to run this gas turbine as often as they had.
Duke denies the charges.
We're offended by the allegations.
Tom Williams is a spokesperson for Duke Energy. He says the plant was turned down during rolling blackouts on orders from state regulators, who said the plant was too polluting to run at full power.
These employees just did not have the complete picture, either on that or on the logs. The ISO could have dispatched those units at will. They had the ability to do that. And again, we did not want to charge the price that we charged.
But California's Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante says the whistleblowers provide further evidence of criminal activity. Bustamante is suing Duke Energy and other big power-generating companies for felony price gouging.
These employees just did not have the complete picture, either on that or on the logs. The ISO could have dispatched those units at will. They had the ability to do that. And again, we did not want to charge the price that we charged.
Regardless of whether they broke the law, there's no doubt Duke's profiting mightily from California's energy crisis. Duke's profits more than doubled in the first 3 months of this year. Between January and March, Duke raked in almost $17 billion. Other power-generating companies have done equally well. The most pronounced increase was at Atlanta-based Mirant. For the first 3 months of this year, revenues totaled more than $8 billion at the company, up from $500 million for the fourth quarter of the year 2000. Mirant is also part of the lieutenant governor's price-fixing suit. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
American James Kopp, wanted in the United States on charges of killing a doctor who performed abortions, has appealed a French court's ruling that he could be extradited. Kopp's lawyers say he is appealing to the Cour de Cassation, France's highest appeals court. The court in the northwestern city of Rennes said Kopp, 46, who was on the FBI most wanted list, could be sent home to answer murder charges as long as he would not face the death penalty if convicted. France banned capital punishment in 1981 and refuses to extradite people who face it abroad. cop was arrested in the nearby town of Dinan in March after more than 2 years on the run. Tony Cross has more from Paris.
American anti-abortion fundamentalist James Kopp may yet face a New York court for the alleged murder of Dr. Barnett Slepian. But then again, he may not, and it could be the death penalty that saves him. Kopp this week appealed against extradition from France. He was hiding here from an international arrest warrant for the 1998 slaying of Slepian, a gynecologist who performed legal abortions in a clinic in New York State. That won Kopp a place on the FBI's 10 most wanted list and an international arrest warrant. Despite his 29 aliases and nicknames, which included Atomic Dog and Catfish, police caught up with Kopp in March in the western French town of Rennes. Last week, a French court ruled that he could be extradited, but he's appealing. The case could even go as far as the European Court of Human Rights. His lawyer, Hervé Rousseau-Leboeuf, says that France can't send Kopp back because he might be executed. Michel Taube heads a campaign called Together Against the Death Penalty. He says that argument could work on appeal.
A lot of democracies have signed international conventions by which a democracy can't extradite a person who risks the death penalty, but in the federal country. So if France wants to respect the international conventions, we can't extradite this man.
The court ruled that Kopp could be extradited thanks to a short note from the U.S. Embassy in Paris, which promised that prosecutors won't ask for the death penalty. Rousseau-Leboeuf, who describes himself as a staunch opponent of capital punishment, says that's not enough for a measure which would require the Prime Minister's signature. The ironies of the case won't have escaped FSRN listeners. Michel Taube, who's the joint author of an open letter to Americans for the abolition of capital punishment, clearly has mixed feelings, but he's sticking to his principles.
But I think that James Kopp is, by certain way, like Timothy McVeigh. Mr. Kopp is an horrible man, too, for me. He doesn't respect other persons. He has killed somebody. And, you know, the French philosopher Voltaire said, "I don't agree with you, but I will fight in order you can say that you don't agree with me." Of course, I am against James Kopp, and I think he must stay in jail for a certain time, perhaps a long time. But I repeat that executing this man, it would mean for me, by a certain way, that we agree with his methods.
Kopp, meanwhile, used his court appearance to protest his innocence. "Who killed Dr. Slepian? That's the question you should be asking," he shouted to reporters. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tony Cross in Paris.
The highly anticipated draft text of the Free Trade Area of the Americas was just released. The release of the text comes almost 3 months after 34 heads of state met in Quebec City, Canada. There they were met by thousands of protesters who opposed any expansion of NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement. Stephen Cooperman reports from Montreal, Canada, on reaction to release of the draft text.
The tens of thousands of protesters have now gone home, as have the thousands of police. They had clashed in Quebec City, Canada, home then of the Summit of the Americas, the third in a series of meetings aimed at creating a hemispheric free trade agreement, excluding Cuba. The organizers of the summit promised the release of the draft text of the agreement, and almost 3 months to the day as promised, it's been posted on the internet in the hemisphere's four official languages, English, French, Spanish, and Portuguese. In Ottawa, International Trade Minister Pierre Pettigrew is calling the release a precedent-setting victory for transparency. But not everyone shares his opinion, especially those who mobilized in Quebec City to oppose the trade negotiations. Mark Lee is an economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, a left-leaning think tank.
When they announced that this text was going to be released, it was in Buenos Aires about 3 weeks before the Quebec summit. And at the time, Minister Pettigrew said that, oh, well, it might be ready in time for the summit, which, of course, we know that since the text was just released, that was a pretty major deception on his part in terms of you know, the reality of the situation. I mean, it was clearly designed to diffuse criticism in the lead up to the summit, while ensuring that the actual text did get released well after the summit was over and after all of the media attention died down.
And one of the people garnering the most media attention at the time of the summit was Maude Barlow. She's often referred to as the Canadian version of Ralph Nader. She's with the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest citizen advocacy group. And for her, as for Lee, there's been many precedents of international agreements being released to the public.
It should always have been transparent. It should have been out months ago, and I would even say it should have been public years ago. When they negotiate international environmental or social or human rights agreements, everybody gets to know what everybody's side is. Just that when they talk about trade, it all has to be secret, and of course the only community that gets to see the negotiations on a day-to-day basis is the big business community.
Meanwhile, almost every sentence of the released draft text that was released is bracketed. The brackets represent sections of the agreement that are still disputed. Lee again on the significance of the released format.
What they have released is what's called a scrub text. For each of the proposals that are being put forward in the text, they've stripped off the name of the country putting forward that proposal. So you don't really know if a particular proposal is coming from the United States, in which case it's a very serious proposal, or if it's coming from Antigua and Barbuda, in which case it's not quite as serious.
Even if transparency has finally arrived, critics of the draft agreement are quick to point out problematic principles of the agreement, which they view as a bill of rights for corporations, especially anything that further enshrines the North American Free Trade Agreement's Chapter 11. This dispute settlement clause allows corporations to sue governments for compensation for lost current and future profits from government actions, as in the case of predatory for-profit health and education corporations. This is particularly problematic for citizens of a country like Canada, priding itself on publicly funded services like healthcare, education, and social security. Maude Barlow again on this question.
For healthcare, for instance, if a country has had public healthcare or public education and you open up the whole system to privatization and competition, then basically big service corporations like, as they say, Lockheed Martin, which delivers or is going to deliver welfare in Texas, this corporation would have the right to dictate the terms of social delivery, social service delivery anywhere in the Americas.
But jeopardizing the delivery of publicly funded services has not been the only area of opposition to trade agreements. As in Latin America, a deep fear exists as to the fate of Canada's natural resources with these trade agreements. Resources such as Canada's much-coveted water or its oil, especially with chronic energy shortages in the United States. Lee again on the potential impact of the current text on the fate of these resources.
In the FTA text, there's a chapter called Competition Policy, which in part has to do with the existence of crown corporations or state monopolies. So, for example, here in British Columbia, we have BC Hydro, a crown corporation that delivers electricity services. If this were to come under attack through the FTAA, I mean, it could potentially force the breakup of BC Hydro, or could put such severe limitations on it that it no longer is able to deliver low-cost electricity to Canadian consumers because it needs to provide access on equal terms to buyers in California, for example.
Whether the release of the draft text will help hinder implementation of the agreement is uncertain, but if opponents of the agreement have their way, it will meet the same fate as the multilateral agreement on investment. A leaked copy of that deal helped mobilize opposition to it and led to its eventual sideline. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Stephen Cooperman in Montreal, Canada.
Yesterday in Tallahassee, Florida, Republican Governor Jeb Bush officially filed papers so he can begin raising money to run for his reelection campaign. The election campaign promises to be one of the most anticipated in the country next year. Nationally, Democrats have targeted the Florida governor's race. There have been reports that the Democratic Party is planning on spending $15 million to defeat the brother of the president. Late last month in Miami Beach, six different men and women who want to replace Bush spoke at a Democratic Party fundraiser, the most noteworthy being former U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. Mitch Perry reports from Miami.
According to Florida Democratic Party officials, the annual Jefferson Jackson dinner in Miami Beach was the greatest in party history, as over 1,500 people raised over $750,000 to get a first glimpse of who might be the candidate to run against Jeb Bush next year. Six of the rumored seven candidates who may vie for the nomination appeared at the dinner. The potential candidates were given only a few minutes to make their pitch. One of the strongest and most specific came from Florida State Senator Darrell Jones, who becomes the first black to run for governor since Alcee Hastings briefly sought the office 11 years ago. Jones used popular resentment against excessive testing in schools as the stick to whack Governor Bush.
I love Florida and America, but I ask you, how long can we remain the greatest economic and military power in the world while our children test in the bottom of first world countries in math and science?
Jones stands with Florida State Representative Lois Frankel as the most progressive candidates to contemplate a run against the governor. Frankel became nationally known to cable news junkies during the Florida recount, and as House Minority Leader, has been a constant thorn in the side to the deeply conservative Florida legislature.
Now let's talk about Jeb Bush. Where do you begin? How about the Civil Rights Commission that found Florida voters were disenfranchised through, and I quote the report, injustice, ineptitude, and inefficiency? To me, that pretty much sums up the last 3 years under Jeb Bush.
Tallahassee Mayor Scott Maddox is only 33 years old. He used his brief time on stage to explain that he's sick and tired of the hypocrisy coming from another government leader's office in Tallahassee.
I'm sick and tired of a governor who claims to care about race relations but unilaterally ended affirmative action. I'm sick and tired of a governor who never went to public schools telling me how to fix them is to take the money out and put them in private schools. I'm sick and tired of a party who is more concerned about whether my child prays in school than learns in school. I'm sick and tired of a party who says that they are the party of Lincoln when they are really the party of Cheney, Gingrich, Buchanan, McCollum, and Feeney.
So far, the surprise candidate in the early days of this contest is former U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno, who every day seems to come closer to making a full-out bid to run for office. Speaking in her home area, where she previously worked as Miami-Dade state attorney, Run Janet Run signs were everywhere Saturday night. But Reno's speech was stilted, and she spoke more in generalities than specifics about what Florida needs in the future.
Public service is one of the most rewarding endeavors anyone can undertake. It is not an easy road. It is not a road to fame or fortune. But the joys of public service are immense.
Although Democratic Party officials have not said much on the record, there are extremely ambivalent reactions privately whether they would be pleased if the controversial Reno is the candidate to run against Bush. One Democrat with universal positive feelings in Florida is the man who would be vice president, Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, who gave the keynote address where he made allusions to last fall's recount.
What a great turnout tonight. This is a record-breaking crowd, isn't it? I understand the Dade County Republicans have estimated there were 100 people here tonight. They're still having trouble with those numbers.
Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Miami Beach.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Verna Avery Brown.